Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is Saturday Night Live house mixer, Robert Bubba Salido. But first of all, let's talk about where people buy their music. And we're talking about people that do actually buy music. But don't forget, there's fewer and fewer people that do that every year. Part of the reason that fewer people buy music is the fact that there's fewer places to actually buy it. This is more and more evident when you go to a store that actually sells CDs, where they have fewer and fewer titles. So if we look at the various places that actually sell music, we come to the big, big box stores like Walmart and Best Buy and Target. Well, it turns out that about 20% of all the music sales come from there. Now, we can look at other chain stores, and about 11% comes from there. Mom-and-pop stores, mom-and-pop record stores that have always been kind of the backbone of the industry, only 7% of all the music is bought from one of those stores. Downloads, we look at iTunes, for instance. 46% of people buy their music from iTunes and from other online sites where you can buy downloads. But where are more and more people buying their music? From Amazon. And I'm talking about CDs. They're buying CDs from Amazon because it's easier, because they can find exactly what they want that they can't find at their local retail store. As we look at all of the places that you can buy music, all of those are decreasing in amount of sales while Amazon is going up and up. So what's happened is more and more people are forced to buy their music online, and they usually go to Amazon to do that. That's not a good trend. Again, if you want to buy music, you're kind of forced to go to someplace that you might not want to go. So we go through the same catch-22 here. If you actually want to buy CDs, there's probably not a place near you that you can actually go to buy a CD. And to make it even worse, if you go to your local Walmart or Target or any place that does have CDs, they have such a small selection that it might not be what you want to buy anyway. So we're finding that we have this catch-22 situation where you want to buy something, but you can't do it because it's not available. So it's a self-fulfilling prophecy in many ways, and that's what's happening in the music business in terms of people buying their music. If you have any questions or comments, send them to questions at bobbyointercircle.com. Don't forget about my new coaching program. It's 101 Mixing Tricks, Big Studio Tricks with a Small Studio. Go to 101mixingtricks.com to learn more. Now, the next thing I want to talk about is choosing monitor speakers. I get a fair amount of questions every month about people buying monitor speakers. What should I buy? Do you like this particular brand? Is this model right for me? And really, when it comes down to it, monitors are so personal that it's hard to make a recommendation because what works for me might not, probably won't work for you. So there's a couple of different things. There's actually three different items that you should think about when you're buying a pair of monitors. The first is, don't choose a monitor just because someone else uses them. That's a surefire way to be disappointed. Because again, in a certain situation, a certain pair of monitors might just work gangbusters on certain types of music, in certain rooms. Every situation is different, and it doesn't mean that your situation is going to line up with that. So it's really not a good idea to buy something because someone else that you know is using them, even if it's someone close to you, let alone someone that's a famous mixer that you read about in a magazine. So don't be fooled into that. Don't buy a monitor because someone else is using them. Second thing is, make sure you listen to the monitors before you buy them. A lot of times, we can get caught up in the hype where we hear about something and everyone raves about it and says it's so great, and we get sucked into it. And if you buy in right away, you might find that as time goes on, you get to use this gear, whatever it might be, you go, I don't know if it works, or I don't know if I hear what everybody else is hearing. As a result, you're better off to make sure that you get a chance to try something before you buy it. And this is especially true with monitors, since everything is so personal with monitors. And it's something that you're going to live with and use more than just about any other piece of gear. So make sure you listen. Now, if you're in a big city, it's kind of easy to be able to go make friends with a audio dealer and get a loaner and be able to sit and play with the monitors for at least a few days. But if that's not possible, at least go to your local guitar center or music store or any place that has a pair of monitors that you want to listen to and sit and listen to them. And listen at length if you can. So what are you listening for? That's something else. Well, you're listening for an even frequency balance. This is important that you hear all of the highs that you want to hear, and the mids that you want to hear, and the lows that you want to hear. And chances are, the less expensive the monitor, the more likely you're going to have either frequency bumps or you're going to have gaps in the frequency response. This happens usually kind of in the mid-range, and it happens at the crossover frequency where there's a little dip. And if that's at the wrong place, you just might not be able to hear your vocal at the right level. So this is something that you have to look for, that your monitors have a nice level frequency response. Now, the other thing you want to do is you want to make sure that that frequency balance stays the same at different levels. So this is especially important for very low levels. And if you abide by any of the methods that many of the pros use of mixing at a very low level for the most part, at least at the very end of your mix, then you know how important it is to have an even frequency response at all levels. And this includes very, very low to very, very high as well. And the final thing is to make sure that those speakers play loud enough without distortion. This, of course, is something that many people overlook because there are times that you want to crank your speakers. When, well, for instance, you have clients over. Well, you really want to crank them up to where they sound fun. And if you can't get enough level, that's bad. If you're doing overdubs, for instance, and you have guitar players that are sitting with you in the control room, chances are they'll want to listen at a louder level. So you want to make sure that you can get the level that you want there. And also, you want to be able to crank the level up enough that you can hear the low frequencies. So make sure that you can get enough level without it distorting, because there are many speakers that have built-in limiters that will actually stop the speaker from distorting, but at the same time, will make sure that it won't get loud enough for you. So that's something to think about. The final thing about choosing monitors is always bring some source material that you know very well. So don't go to the place to listen to these monitors unless there's something that you know that you can play. So for instance, what would that be? Well, it could be a CD that you just think sounds fantastic, and you're going to play that. Make sure it's not an MP3. Make sure it's a high-resolution source of some type. It might be something that you've worked on that you know what it sounds like, and you're so sure you know what that sounds like that you'll be able to hear any deficiencies in the speakers. So those are the three things that you should think about when choosing a monitor. Don't choose a monitor because somebody else is using them. Make sure that you listen to the monitors before you buy them, and listen with some source material that you know very, very well. My guest today is my longtime friend, Robert Bubba Salido, who's been mixing the house sound for Saturday Night Live for 27 years. Bubba's mixed just about every superstar that you can think of while working on one of the most revered shows ever on television. I talk with him via Skype from his home in New Jersey. Tell me about your gig at SNL. Tell me exactly what you do there.
Oh, well, for the last 27 years, I've been mixing the front of house for the studio audience. So I mix the production. At this point, I used to be the music mixer, and it's a two-man job these days, so I entertain the audience.
Well, wait, hit me with that. So it's a two-man job, you say?
Yeah. I mean, well, it's, you know, I now have a Vista. It's always been, you know, I mean, some of the sketches get quite difficult, but now we have a Vista 8 Studer console.
Mm-hmm.
I have 256 inputs coming into it. So, you know, there's the guest band, the house band, plus all the production elements. So it gets quite intense incorporating that into a, you know, interfacing that so you can access it to do the show, you know, the mechanics of mixing the show and making the console actually be able to do that.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about that for a second. That's an awful lot of inputs that you have. What's the most difficult thing? So, like you say, you have the house band, you have the guest band, you have the cast. So, what's most difficult out of all that?
Nothing's really. Well, I mean, sometimes sketches are booms, sometimes they're booms and RFs. I mean, the most difficult thing's been, I mean, always trying to. I mean, at one time we used to have three consoles, but I mean, some of the stuff, I mean, probably some of the musical sketches are probably some of the more difficult things to mix, you know, because sometimes they're lav RFs and sometimes we use handhelds, but, you know, just the mechanics of making that work on the console was the most difficult in this layout. But, you know, I basically, since the console has 60 faders and has six levels, I've become to figure out how to create buckets for certain sketches and then go from level to level and customize levels. You know, so sometimes I'm not looking at everything.
Instead of doing scenes, then you're just doing...
Because actually what happens is when we do the guest bands, we switch scenes because we can, you know, but really when it becomes the sketches, it becomes difficult to snapshot through the show.
Yeah.
Because you never, well, particularly with the Studer, you couldn't reorder the, well, it was a quirk with the console, according to Studer, that you couldn't, once you set a line of snapshots, you know, there was no way to reconfigure them. So you couldn't, you know, so when I would thought we could do that, then it was sort of like, what do you mean that doesn't work? I don't know if there's changing in the hardware. I mean, the software that makes that happen. My brother-in-law, Kenny Newman, who mixes Barry Manilow, says he found a way around that somehow, you know. But yeah, it was, you know, I thought that I would be able to do snapshots, and then it just became the whole, just because the show, you know, the show is always evolving. So, you know, by the time you get to 11:30, the orders change, and sometimes you don't know, you know, what the order is going to be in. You know, sometimes it changes during the show. So they'll drop a sketch, you know, keep a VT, cut a VT, switch the orders and stuff. So I ended up not doing snapshots where I ended up just, I mean, I'd be changing, all I would really be doing is changing beta inputs around anyway. So, you know, I figured a different way around it.
Yeah.
By using less, you know, because sometimes, you know, there's 10 faders in a bucket. I can fit enough of the production elements into a bucket.
When we're talking about production elements, what exactly are you getting?
Oh, well, there's 24 RF microphones. There's videotape, audio tape, two channels of sound effects, and then there's 48 channels of house band and guest band. So, you know, the guest band is a separate identity, but then again, the house band needed to be, you know, when there's music in a sketch, whether it's just background music, that's live, because a lot of times things are on tape, but sometimes there's live music and sometimes they sing with the live music. That's the challenge of incorporating those two elements together.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably the most challenging thing to do on the show. But then again, I don't need, you know, once again, I don't need, you know, like the house band. You never really need to see everything.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that has something that I think most engineers have gotten used to today, is that, you know, on a digital console. Unlike, you know, if you had a big show like that back in, you know, in the analog days, whether it was a TV show and or if you were going to see somebody in concert, you're talking three consoles.
Yeah.
You know, stuck together. Today, in a digital console, you know, there's different ways to skin the cat. Well, so to speak.
Well, you've been there for 27 years. Tell me what you have in terms of gear, how that's evolved.
Oh, well, that's, you know, 27 years ago, I had 12 EV speakers. When I went there first, it was 12 EV speakers facing the balcony, which was, that's what they did, you know, and we used to, I don't know what they did before that, but then I had the rented Midas console. Today, there's a $2 million system, you know, which was rebuilt 3 years ago. So there's probably 89 speakers in the studio.
I guess that's made it easier for you then, right?
Yeah. The sounds at Duncan Edwards, he did the sound design. And he did a really nice job on laying out the speakers and finding the speaker to do the right job.
Yeah.
I mean, most people come up and look at it and go like, why do you need that many speakers? But when you look at the box and understand what the box does, because it's a very narrow, it has a very narrow horn in it. So the horn is 20 by 60. So it really doesn't cover a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
So there's an array of three boxes. I don't know how, I couldn't count the arrays, but the boxes are in three arrays. And due to the fact that the horns are so narrow, you really need to be on the horn to hear the intelligible frequencies.
Mm-hmm.
So it actually, the three boxes, you know, the top box covers the people up in the upper part of the balcony. The middle box covers the people in the sort of in the middle of the balcony, and then the bottom speaker covers the first couple rows in the balcony. It looks like a lot of speakers, but in the end, it's sort of, you got to think of zones.
Yeah.
So there's lots of little zones. You know, if you see, it's a JM. One, I think it's a JMP1, and John Myers, basically the design concept is, if you need to put sound somewhere where you can't get it and you want to isolate it, that's what the box does.
Oh, got it. So it's a Myers system?
Right,
then?
So it's a Myers system. Yeah. So if you go to his website and look at the box, he actually calls it Point Source Redefined.
Yeah.
So, you know, like I always tell people, I mean, We try to think that we're doing, most people are in our business, most people seem to think that we've made a lot of advances, but at the same time, we're not doing much more than we did back in 1970, in the 70s and whatnot, where you went to the Fillmore East and you see those old pictures, guys are taking horns and pointing them at people's ears. It's the same old concept. It's just getting intelligible frequencies on people's heads. And if you look at the old pictures of the Fillmore, they've got, you can see what they're up to. They've got multicellular horns and other horns pointing wherever they want to put sound. And then, unbeknownst to me, after I bought a book about the Fillmore, that they had a flying rig in there. They had a sound system they used to take up in the air.
Wow. The sound I remember that was all horn-based, the sound reinforcement stuff, in the 70s, it sounded better. The horn sounded better, and then when we went to line arrays eventually, I don't think the sound has ever been as good as it was, you know, way back when.
Interesting story is I became good friends with Brian Ruggle, who mixes Billy Joel. And Brian worked with me for 3 years at SNL mixing the music. And what he does, so most people tell you, if you take a line array outside, you get a good wind, it goes bye-bye.
Yeah, right.
It'll just blow it away. And Brian, when he does stadiums, when he did Shea Stadium, and whenever he does outdoor gigs, he gets Claire Brothers to dig up every S4 they can get. And he'll stack 90 S4s aside. You know, because that's, I mean, it's, you know, because that's the best way to do it.
Yeah.
You know, he literally gets them. If he was playing, he does a gig today and he's outside, he gets every S4 he can find.
Wow.
He just tells Claire Brothers. He did when he did the last show that Billy did at Shea. You know, I woke up the next day and opened the Daily News, and I called him immediately and said, I said, what did you do last night? Because everybody's raving about the sound.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a lot of times what, you know, I won't argue a point that line arrays have a purpose, but then again, you know, I will still tell people it's at times when you go, you know, the old Perkins bins and older horns, then they're still in the right hands, functional equipment that you can make sound good.
Yeah. Do you ever have a feedback problem?
No, not so much these days. I mean, honestly, between you and me, I mean, feedbacks, you need to figure out how to conquer it, but, you know, after 27 years, I can pretty much get a rig up and running without having feedback, without it really having problems. I mean, not severe feedback. No, I mean, you know, I mean, if I push it, I have to know when to stop, but, you know, not in particular, no. Duncan's done a really good job of, you know, keeping sound, you know, where it's supposed to be. And it's gotten quite complicated, you know, not complicated, sophisticated on the floor. And we now we're muting and unmuting zones and whatnot. Because they want to hear sound on the floor.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, we have a whole Myers Dimitri, which is sort of a console within inside a computer. So, you know, we've become quite sophisticated at SNL.
Wow.
But I mean, even talking about feedback today, my basic theory is I EQ the microphone and then I worry about the system. Back in the day, I might have said, oh, I better EQ my rig. And then today, I just look at all the elements and I start with the microphones. I just, you know, I can get a rig up and running in a very short amount of time. So, you know, it's like this. If there's anything you can do, you can, if you don't like the way, once you get it up and running, you can always figure out what you want to do it if you're not that happy with it.
Yeah.
You know. But no, feedback's not rarely an issue at SNL. I mean, not with the system today. But it's basically been the old EV system, which went away, and then it's been a succession of different Myers speakers and different configurations, and then it was this decision to make a total rebuild where there's a Lavo Matty router and the Studer was put into place, and then the speaker system. So, you know, there's quite a lot of speakers in the studio.
Yeah, but after 27 years, you'd figure that, and especially since SNL keeps on making money, you know, eventually they'd do that. It's a crown jewel of NBC, so sure, they'd spend the money on that.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, TV people in general, I don't think were, you know, they're in the video business.
Yeah.
So audio wasn't something they particularly cared about 20 or 30 years ago. But today, I mean, most of the, you know, Fallon has a total Myers system with a Constellation speaker system. They pay a lot more attention to the live sound today than they did in the past. You know, it's like, well, you got to think about it. They're in the picture business.
Yeah.
I tell people, it's like, when it was radio station, audio was the king, and then the picture tube came along, and it was like they've never stopped looking at it. Like, what? But it's changed a lot. Their attitude towards live sound on a television show and what it takes to do it. So, you know, you'd be surprised how, you know, interested they are in on the sound of their shows today. Not just SNL, but all their shows.
Well, you work in other shows too, right?
Oh, yeah. Wow. I started out with my first TV venture was the night music show, which was a total music show. And then I drifted to SNL. And then from SNL, I did Rosie O'Donnell for a while. I did Last Call with Carson Daly for a while. I did Carolyn Ray for a while. I mean, you know, so I've done mixing and whatnot on the Today Show at times, the live stuff. So yeah, I've done, you know, I just did a Love and Hip Hop Hollywood reunion, and I do some Comedy Central stuff, stand up comedy shoots. You know, I just did one Amy Schumer presents Rachel Feinstein.
Oh yeah,
which was a yeah. So I do a lot of that. I did some music. I did the Vibes Festival a couple years ago, mixing to their radio broadcast station, which was very nice. It was challenging, actually, because we didn't have too much time to get up. A lot of the lesser known bands were apt to letting you mix them. Some of the more well known acts were, they had you take the front of house left and right feed. But that was a good time too.
Well,
I find I do production more these days.
Yeah. Well, coming back to SNL, so you're all union, right? So the house engineer for the band, for instance, the guest band, they can't mix. They have to tell you what they need, or are they there at all?
Some are interested and some are not, you know, when that happens. I mean, it really depends on the band. And how, you know, if they're, whether or not they're real. I mean, if there are certain needs, they're gonna come and talk to you. But most of them are more interested in the broadcast mix.
Yeah.
So, you know, unless they're very unhappy in the studio, and then that's rarely the case.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but if there's anybody who, you know, the quirkiest thing we ever did was when Prince was on. Prince wanted the same mix everywhere. And that's how he, you know, friends of mine that knew him from the touring business, he doesn't use a fallback operator. Everything happens from front of house. And when he does sound check, he takes his guitar, he goes out, he runs the console, and he gets himself happy, and that's what it is. So he came in and he made everybody take the two mix from the music room and put it up.
Well, it's easy for you.
Well, yeah, and it actually didn't sound bad, but you know, but that's how he, you know, and I can understand his thinking on it is that he doesn't want to talk to two guys or three guys. He wants to talk to one person.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, since we're both musicians, you can sort of understand that, you know, he doesn't want to talk to three people or two people about, oh, this mix, that mix. You know what? This is the way it is. That's what he does. I think he folds back the front of house mix back to himself when he's out on the road. But there's no monitor mixer when he tours. It's just a front of house guy.
Wow. That's different.
Yeah. That real different. Oh, one time when Neil Young was on, we had to hang speakers in the grid. Don't want any wedges. So speakers had to go in, so he was just acoustic Neil, and Neil, we had to take speakers and hang them up in the grid and point them down at him, and that's what you. Some people have quirky things.
Yeah.
You find interesting, you know. And some people come in and there's you know, everybody's got a monitor mixer.
Yeah.
I mean, U2 has everybody, and U2 has a monitor. Everybody. There's a monitor mixer for Bono. There's a monitor mixer for the drummer. There's a monitor mixer for the bass player. There's a monitor mixer for Edge.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because a good friend of mine owns SSE, the sound company in the UK that does U2, mostly in Europe, but occasionally they take a system, you know, here as well in the States. So they were playing in LA, and my friend happened to come over, and he said, "Hey, you want to go to the show?" So yeah, go to the show. And he takes me backstage, and he says, "Come here, I want to show you this." And we go underneath the stage, and it was monitor land. And that's where...
Yeah, the bunker. That's called the bunker.
And that's where all the monitor mixers were, one for everybody, and the guitar tech and keyboard tech, and it was pretty interesting, I got to say.
And they call that the bunker. That's the nickname. That first time they ever did it, that's when they, Dave Scaff and Claire Brothers, when they first came up with the scheme, they used to call, their nickname was the bunker. That's what they called it, the bunker. If you were underneath the stage. You know, they wanted my friend Tom Herman to do it when they first did it, and I said, "What do you want? You want to go, Tom?" And I go, "No." I said, "What are you going to do?" He goes, "Well, I'm going to give them a price they won't pay." And then I came to work the next day, and I walked in. I go, "Well, what happened?" He goes, "I had to tell them no because I go, what happened?" He goes, "Because they told me they'd pay the price I thought they would pay."
Wow.
But
wow.
Yeah, and yeah, and well, Tomo, when he had done Sting, and the Police had met Joe O'Hurley, he'd in front of House Guy, and they got along, so they really wanted Tomo to do the tour, and Tomo was just not, I don't know if he wanted to live in the bunker.
Yeah. Well, being on the road, too, you know, when you're used to being at home all the time, it's a lot different. Everybody I know that works for you too has always, and they work forever for them. Once you get hired, you stay there until you want to leave.
No, I said they treat their people extremely well.
Yeah. Everybody loves them.
Scaff left, and you know they didn't want Scaffy to leave. But you know, after a while, it's
yeah.
That's if you don't want to live that life anymore.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Well, let's come back to SNL. What's your week like?
The week is Thursday. Yeah, they write Monday to Wednesday, and then they have their read-through. And then Thursday you have guest band sound check, so they load in. They sound check, they camera block the band. And then once that's done, around 3 o'clock or so, then we do promos. And then we rehearse sketches till around 8 or 9 o'clock at night. And then Fridays we come back in and 1 o'clock to whenever they're done, but typically 11, we rehearse sketches. And then Saturday it's back in at 9:30 and you sound check the house band. And then at 1 o'clock, once again, then we, by that time, you know, most of the rehearsals up until then are partial sets, no costumes. Saturday, then it's actors are in costumes, sets are basically finished, and then we rehearse up until around 5:30. Then the band comes back, the guest band sound checks once again, around 7 o'clock, we finish up with possibly the monologue or whatever we didn't do. And then we'll do update. And then 8 o'clock, we do a dress rehearsal from 8 to 10. Then we take a break. They figure out what, they're going to mount for at 11:30. And then at 11:30 to 1 o'clock, it's off to the races. So then but that's basically, it transpires all in 2 days.
Mm-hmm. Well, I remember when last time I visited you, which is quite a while ago, I was amazed that you were getting changes right up to the minute before the show started. I mean, 2 minutes before the show started, I remember you getting, new pages.
That still happens. Nothing's changed. Around 11:25, and it could be that late, but you hope to get them early. But 11:25, pages are gone. Things have changed. Sketches, whole pages could be gone.
Mm-hmm.
So all that. I think that's the biggest challenge is then to wrap your head around everything and then, figure out how to. Well, I mean, it's kind of it's kind of crazy to rehearse something one way and have it not be that way when you have to do it again. Because it's always, I tell most people, you know, I have a real hard time, you know, like thinking about, like, would I really want to do another talk show, which is very formulated. It's a basic 8-hour day. You go in, and then once you get there, it's the opening tape. It's with the band. Then it's the monologue. Then it's, you know, guest interview. It becomes very monotonous after all. SNL is not boring. You know, it's never, because it's never the same. You know, matter of fact, besides the script changes, up until 1 o'clock, whatever, you don't know what's going to happen. Anything can happen.
Yeah.
You know, if they run out of time, they're going to drop a sketch or drop a videotape. Or, you know, I actually, back in the past, have seen them put sketches back in the show that were put out of the show.
Huh. What's the best show that you can remember doing?
Oh, that's hard to say. You know, there's been so many. I don't think I really have a favorite. You know, there's just been a lot of amazing times. I mean, I watch TV today. I go, oh, really? Was I there? If I see a rerun, I go, really? What was that? Well, I was there for that. You know, so it's I really don't have a favorite show.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Is there
memorable time? Actually, you know, the weird part is, like, I'll tell you, you know, Justin Bieber was on when he first came out, and then I'll have to tell people, I'll look at people and tell you, like, you know, I really like Justin Bieber. It was a good show. I mean, the dancing down was, well, my daughter is a dancer, so I did a lot of dancing things, and he would, you know, it was a good show. The dancing was really good.
Yeah.
There's lots of, YouTube's been on. I mean, YouTube's been on. That's always good.
You've always been Clapton and McCartney and just all the icons. Jeez.
Well, actually, I have to say that, you know, I look at most people, you know, Clapton's been on. I mixed Clapton when he did the blues thing, because that's when I was still mixing the music part of it. I mixed Paul McCartney. But I've done that beforehand. I mean, so I have to say that, you know, if you're doing live sound and you have to go, if you're a mixer, you usually end up with, like, a couple of clients, but, you know, in reality, mixing TV, I've probably mixed most major artists at least once. I've mixed Mick Jagger, I've mixed Keith Richards, I've mixed Paul McCartney, I've mixed, you know, I'll look at TV and I go, really? Can I do that? I mixed Sting.
Yeah, right.
But I'm just saying that, you know, James Taylor, it's just, you know, sometimes you just sit there. Even on when I did night music, it was the same thing, you know, because it was just different people. So it's always, you know, it's always been interesting. Things are always changing. It's just, things are different all the time.
I mean,
Adele's on this week. I got to mix her the first time she was on the show, which was really good. Yeah, you know, it's hard to say what I like, and I, you know, because it's so diversified with music.
Was there
depending who's on?
Was there a show that was bad?
No. I really can't. You know, I honestly can't say that. You know, people are so diverse. Music's so diversified. You have to sort of put your likes and dislikes about what you like away and just do your job.
Yeah,
you're hired to make people sound good. So, I really can't think of a show or an act that I didn't like or was really bad, you know, because no one's been really bad.
Okay. Well, the last time I talked to you, you said that, it was in an email, I think. And I congratulated you about your Emmy on the 40th anniversary show. But you said that was one of the toughest gigs you had.
Well, that was an extremely, extremely challenging show. It was really, because it was 3.5 hours live. That was originally supposed to be a lot of videotape that went from, more sketches than there was video.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it was good. You know, I honestly, if I have to say that I won the Emmy for that show, I'm proud of that because I really mixed my butt off.
Yeah. Well, 3.5 hours.
It was quite challenging. You know, and then technically putting it together, I mean, Paul Shorter from Studer came out with another Studer console, which we interfaced into the system. And then he brought me the remote console to the Studer, which he didn't bring the Wi-Fi interface. It was hardline, but it was just it ended up to be another bucket, and I actually used it to mix certain elements of the show because I would, once again, I would just set up buckets and then make notes about where I was going to go mix something from, because you can basically, on a Studer, it's just, if I wanted to make it all channel one, it's channel one. And if I push up one fader, all the faders come up. It's not a duplicate, it's the same thing. So basically, I would find ways to, you know, configure faders somewhere else where I could get at them. And I mean, it was quite challenging to figure out how to, because then it escalated to, we had 48 RF microphones.
Wow.
And 72 RF changes.
Jeez. Do you have someone on staff that just takes care of the RFs?
They have an RF department.
Oh, got it.
But that's literally the 24 plus another 24. So we bought in a pack, another 24, which gave us 48, and that still wasn't enough.
Wow.
So we had 72 microphone change.
Unbelievable. Wow. No wonder.
When we submitted shows before, you know, that we never got nominated for. And, you know, so I'd get aggravated because I said, you know, well, we keep nominating. You submit the show to be nominated. That's what you need to do. And then they look at their nominations and then they decide what shows or four or five shows that get nominated. So I've been nominated once before for Colbert show that I did on the Intrepid. And then I was kind of getting to the end going, like, are they ever going to like nominate us out of being submitted? So finally we got, and actually I have to say that, you know, if I ever deserve something, I deserve something. Really. But everybody that mixed on the show really deserved, because it was quite incredible. But, you know, some of the stuff that we ended up doing. I mean, we did this sketch called Marty and Beyonce. It was Marty Short and Maya Rudolph being Beyonce. And it was just like, it just went from them and then somebody else. And it was music. And then it went to some Bill Murray. And then we did Joe Piscopo, and it was as Frank Sinatra. And we cut to him. And then we decided, well, you know, he was singing part of a song, and the mixer goes, "We're going to add the handheld microphone." Well, we never used the handheld microphone, so you know, you had to get in your head like, "Okay, he's going to talk on a lot, and guess what? He's going to pick up a microphone we never heard." And boink, we did it.
Wow!
I never heard the microphone. It was just like, "Okay, we're adding the microphone. Okay, not a problem." Remember, I'll still tell you my handheld six.
Yeah. Wow.
You know. No, it was quite an accomplishment. So to actually, you know, 3.5 hours live and some of the stuff that we that we actually we mounted. So
yeah,
it was very. I was very happy to win this.
Well, congratulations.
There was other ones. I wouldn't mind winning the other ones either. But, you know, there was a couple of because I suggested some shows to submit, and we had done like. One actress, and she did a singing monologue, and I went, let's submit it, because we really broke our, you know, we really did a good job on it, you know, but that, it's, you know, you get, whatever category you're in becomes part of the thing, so you get lumped into variety specials, so it's the Grammys, the Oscars, you know, which in their own right are large, complicated shows.
Yeah, sure.
That get, you know, but it was good.
Okay, last question for you. What's the best piece of business advice that you either learned along the way or someone imparted to you?
Oh, You'll like this one. Remember Tony Texera from Berkeley, the guy who took the commercial class?
You bet, yeah.
Yeah, remember him? Well, I took the commercial writing class, and he sat there. He goes, never sell ties, because if you start selling ties, that's what you'll do for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
So my advice is, once you dive in, just stay at it.
Yeah.
You know, if you want to be in the music business or engineering business, it's a little, you know, today or back then, if that's what you want to do, I think that was the best advice. Don't do something else, because then you drift off.
That's what I always tell everybody too. You know that persistence is more important than talent, even. Understand?
Yes, at times. Yes, I mean you can acquire your talent later. I mean it helps if you're talented, but you know, I have to say when I sat in Tony's class and he told me that, he goes, "If you don't sell ties, you're gonna stay talented." And I'm like, "Okay, and, you know." I got out of, you know, when I graduated Berkeley, I got out and I did what everybody else did. I found myself a gig and I wanted to be a recording engineer, but I got into live sound. And that's what I said, okay, this is what I'll do. I was talented at it and I did a good job. And I was good at recording too. But, you know, at the same time, I would go to recording studios and assists would look at me and go like, you think this is fun? Because isn't it much more fun to be in sitting in the middle of the live audience, and it's, so everybody has a different perception.
Yeah, right.
What is fun? You know, I still think that, you know, 15 hours in the studio is a lot of fun.
Well, I don't know about that. After just spending two of those days, I can tell you that I'm paying the price today.
Yeah, well, I mean, even what I do, I mean, I've had, you know, I mean, thanks to you. I'll tell anybody, I've had a wonderful life. I've had a great career. I cannot be, you know, disappointed at all, you know.
Yeah.
For all the things I've done. But to me, it's persistent, you know. It's, I like the story about when Metallica moved from San Francisco to Brooklyn, because there was the heavy metal scene in Brooklyn, and they went to that old factory that all these bands would rent rooms in and would literally live in, and they sat there and literally ate bologna and white bread sandwiches. You know, it's that persistence. Especially with musicians. I tell them all the time, you want to be a musician, you better be willing to suffer, because there's going to be at times, there's going to be times you're going to suffer.
Yeah.
You know, that's the way it is, especially if you want to. I always equate it as there's a lot of difference between a musician and a rock star. So, you know, a musician, you can got to figure out how to just keep yourself busy. But, you know, if you want to be a rock star, especially that career, you better be willing at times to, you know, knuckle down. And it becomes that thing about being persistent.
Yeah.
You know, and once you get your, you know, I tell people, you know, it's a lot easier having a 9-to-5 job and then go to work, come home. But when you have a career, it's a different thing.
Yeah.
You know, it's like what we pursue, it's a career. So it chews a lot of your time up.
Well, this has been great. Speaking of time, thank you for the time that you just spent with me. This is great.
No, that's okay. It's always good. We don't spend enough time talking anyway.
No, we don't. That's for sure. Bubba doesn't have a huge online footprint, but you can find out more about him if you go to LinkedIn and do a search. That's Robert Bubba Sellitto. Robert Sellitto, S-E-L-I-T-T-O. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any comments or questions, send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. Many thanks to Steve Cherubino. He's the host of the EDM Producer Podcast at edmmr.com. Thank you, Steve, for putting the show together. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, or find it on iTunes, Stitcher, Mixcloud, or Google Play. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyoinnercircle.com, you'll find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.